I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ida. Whenever I hear that anonymity statement, my heart starts to go pound, absolutely pound, because I know what's next. It's like climb up. It's good to be here. This room was my second meeting outside of the treatment center that I was in, and that was 12 years ago. And I can remember coming to the Tuesday meeting, the beginners meeting, and as everybody was going around the room introducing themselves, everybody was going, 10 years, 12 years, or that's the way it seemed to me anyway, 15 years sobriety, and I was sitting there with 3 days. And I was sweating then, too. I didn't know what I was going to say when it came to my turn, except to introduce myself and say that I'm an alcoholic. And it took a lot of years for me to get to the point where I could say that. And it wasn't comfortable and it wasn't easy, because in my book, an alcoholic was somebody you see out on the park bench in a trench coat, with a flask in the pocket. I didn't see myself that way, although I walked around in a business suit with a briefcase and a bottle of scotch in there. So it wasn't much different, just a notch above, but same thing, right? I needed to have that drink with me, and I always made sure that I had that bottle when I felt I was running out or I needed something. So I'll just go back to the beginning. I always start back at the beginning, because for me it's a remember when, not only of a time, not only my drunkalogue when I stopped drinking, but also what it was like at home and how much I have changed, how much my perspective has changed of what life used to be like and what it's like today. And it's important for me to remember that, particularly when I'm not having a terrific day. I think, oh gee, woe is me, the pits. And there are those days, but there are also a lot of good days. I'm the youngest of five of immigrant parents who came here, like all immigrants, wanting better for their children. I was not a grateful child. When my parents arrived here, we lived in the St. Urban Street area, which is now a very trendy spot to be. At that time, it was an immigrant area. And I felt very, very different. We were different. We couldn't speak the language. We didn't dress the way everybody else dressed. I felt particularly sensitive to that, I think. And so I was ashamed of my family from way back. And keeping secrets was a way of life way back. Because when I was about 10 years of age, my mother just changed religion and converted to being a Jehovah's Witness, and I was going to a Catholic school. So I was quite accustomed to telling stories to the nuns as need be, Whenever there was a holiday, I'd go in and say, oh yes, we had a wonderful Christmas. In fact, we never observed Christmas. All the holidays stopped with my mother's conversion. So early on in life, I got accustomed to living a double life. I was one thing to the people I wanted to fit in with, and I was something else when I went home. I did what was popular at the time, to get away from family and get out of the house. I got married, and I thought I was going to live happily ever after. The house, the white picket fence, the 2.2 children, everything was going to be just utopia. Well, utopia lasted for about 5 years and ended in divorce. And I quickly became involved with someone else. And again, it was a problematic relationship. The man was married. So again, there was a lot of secrecy surrounding that. And all through that, I turned my back on my family. I wanted nothing to do with them. I wanted nothing, didn't associate with them very much. And life went on until the partner that I was with died very suddenly in a 24-hour period from diagnosis to time of death. And I found myself truly, truly alone. I didn't have family. I didn't have friends because of the nature of our relationship. And I didn't know where to go. And it was at that time that alcohol became my solution and my friend. Prior to that, drinking was very, you know, Saturday night you'd have a glass of wine or a bit of sherry or something like that, and then the bottle would go away in the cupboard and you'd bring it out the following week, sort of dust it off and pour a drink and then put it back again. After my partner's death, my drinking took off. It was the only way I knew how to deal with what was going on in my life. I was hurting. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know how to deal with it. So alcohol became my friend. And I worked my way through every bottle that we had in the bar. It didn't matter what it was, so long as it put me out, put me to sleep, and enabled me to forget what was going on in my life. And of course, the next day I'd get up and I'd go back to work and do what I had to do. But when I came home at 5 o'clock, it was like, come to mama. I knew that my solution was in that bottle. And at that time, I realized that my drinking was not normal. Okay, I knew that that was not the way to live. And I was seeing a therapist at the time, and she was on my case about my drinking, you know, sort of, how much do you drink? And I'd say, one drink. And she said, well, what does it look like? And my scotches looked like the color of a Guinness, you know. I mean, there was no water in there. It was just straight up. So with her sort of supporting me and on my case a little bit and whatever, my drinking, I got under control. I won't say I ever did more than that. And then I discovered, once I started to feel better, I discovered that I was in my mid-30s, I lived downtown, and I discovered every bar in town. I discovered the bars up and down Crescent Street, mostly Mackay. I mean, you name it, I knew it, and I could close it. 3 o'clock in the morning was not uncommon for me to be drinking and getting up the next day to go to work. I was able to do it. It was not a problem. But again, at some point, you know, the realization that this is not the way other people drink. This is not normal behavior, because everything focused around drinking. If I was going out, it wasn't because I wanted to see you particularly. It was because of the drinks I was going to have. I never, ever stopped at one. If I did, it was a major, major effort to stop at one, and probably because I was trying to control it and to impress someone. And I couldn't wait to get home to have another one and another one and another one. I mean, I would have friends over, and it was always an excuse to stock up the bar. And every time I did that, I can remember pushing the cart around the grocery store, or the grocery store, the SAQ, and filling it up and getting to the cash and feeling compelled to tell the man at the cash that I was having a party. It was really important to me to explain why I had 20 bottles in my cart. You know, that was really important. And I always bought everything that I thought you might want to drink, and then some. Okay? Because I was, at this point, all my friends drank the same way I drank. So when they came for dinner, everybody brought a bottle of wine. And I used to get really annoyed when, at the end of the evening, all the bottles were gone. And my idea was, well, you brought that for me as a gift. How come you drank it? You know, you weren't supposed to do that. So I always made sure I had a few extra. And for me, I look back on it, and it amazes me. I mean, the things that seemed quite normal, cleaning up after everybody had been and pouring all the glasses into one glass, into what became a rosé, you know, everybody's dregs into a glass. Mind you, I used to do the same with cigarettes when I smoked. If I ran out of cigarettes, I'd pick them out of public ashtrays, you know. It's like, oh, yuck. Not proud, but I did it. So that was a pattern. You know, everybody left, the drinks would get poured into one glass, and I'd still be drinking at 3 o'clock in the morning. And again, the secrecy was there, because every time I restocked when I had friends over, for some reason I felt that they would remember how much was left in a bottle. So I was keeping 40 ounces in my bedroom closet and the 26s in the kitchen. I was hiding booze from myself when I lived alone. I mean, that's how normal my thinking was. You know, the stock was in the bedroom, the stuff that I wanted you to see was in the kitchen. I was busy pouring and topping up bottles before people came over. Nobody remembered. Nobody gave a damn. And by the time they left, they were as sloshed as I was, so they didn't have a clue. But to me, it was important to do that. And again, the realization that this was not normal drinking. But the hiding continued and the drinking continued, so that by the time, at my peak, I'll put it that way, a bottle of scotch was the norm. Two bottles of wine, not unusual. And I used to do the math, you know, because every time I read an article that said, well, an average drink is 1.5 ounces and don't drink more than 2 a day, I'd do the calculation. I'd say, well, that's 3 ounces. And I bought that bottle of scotch and there was only this much left. So that means I had 22 ounces and that was X number of drinks. And then, of course, I passed out and didn't do any more with that information. But I was aware. I was aware that the drinking was in excess and that it was becoming a problem. But if you saw me going to work, everything was just so. You know, I made an extra special effort because I knew what I was hiding, so I'd make that extra special effort to cover it up and to look good. Because it was really important that you didn't know, and it was really important to me how I looked to you. So the suit was out, the briefcase was there, everything was done, the nails, the hair, the whole bit. But coming home at night, I made sure that I had my supply. I mean, I knew every route home that had a dépanneur or a liquor store. So some days I'd take the low road along Sherbrooke Street, other days I'd go along Penfield, because I was aware I didn't want to go to the same dépanneur 2 nights in a row, because they might know. It was like the guy at the liquor store, you know? I'm having a party. So I plotted out my route home according to where the liquor stores were or where the depths were, and made sure that I had my supply when I got home. And that included when my mother was in hospital, she was very sick. I mean, I used to go to hospital to visit her. I couldn't wait to get out of the hospital to have a drink. But I made sure that I had that bottle in my briefcase so that I would have it when I got home. So I was aware, I knew that this drinking was not normal. But you know what? I didn't know how to stop it. Not once. From the time my drinking took off, I don't remember once not having a drink for a week. Maybe when I visited my sister in Guelph, maybe. Otherwise, it was daily. It was daily through the evening and until I passed out. But you know, my world became smaller and smaller as I went. Huh? Where I used to have friends in, I wasn't having friends in because my drinking was escalating. Where I used to pour myself a drink and then go to the kitchen to get another one, I'd bring the bottle to the phone. I didn't bother going back into the kitchen. And this is before the days of cordless phones. I had the longest cord on my phone, so I wouldn't have to interrupt my conversation. I could just take it with me and go back and forth. Never missed a beat. Didn't miss a drink and didn't miss the conversation. But with time, the conversation stopped too, because at a certain point, I didn't know how much I could say without slurring, without sounding stupid. And I didn't want to talk too long because chances are I wouldn't remember the conversation the next day. I was blacking out. So the conversation stopped as well. So my world went from driving and going out to my apartment. There was a dépanneur in the building so I could get my supplies there. I didn't have to, you know, didn't have to go too far. And I wonder what that man thought, you know, because I'd be down there at 10:30 in the morning getting a bottle of wine. By 1 o'clock, I'd be back for another one. By 5 o'clock, I had a whole crowd coming for dinner. And, I mean, I was just drinking them through the day. And Sunday was my day of rest, because I had to sober up enough to go back to work on Monday. And that's the way my world just shrunk and closed in on me. My solution to my drinking was to move. I thought if I moved and I became a responsible homeowner, then I wouldn't drink that way anymore, because then I would have neighbors and I would be more public and I wouldn't live in the anonymity of an apartment building, you know, where you could just shove the bottles down the chute and nobody knew where they came from. Just this big bang when they hit the bottom and, you know, who knows where they came from. But when I moved and I did buy a condo, I thought that would sober me up. But the only thing that changed there was that I didn't have a chute anymore to put the bottles down. I was wrapping them up in newspaper because I was putting them out in the street, and I didn't want people to know that all these clanky bottles had come from, like, they would know it was my garbage bag. You have to, you know, the paranoia. I mean, it was my garbage bag. They would know that I had put it out there. So nothing changed. The drinking didn't change. In fact, it probably got worse. And because I think I realized that nothing was different. So I was in the condo probably 3 months tops, living in fear, waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning in sweats, worried that I would die and everybody would discover this horrible, horrible secret that I was an alcoholic. Terrified that people would know. And surprisingly, nobody at work ever said anything. I could not have smelled pretty, because when you consume a bottle of scotch the night before, I can't believe that there were fumes coming off me the next morning. Nobody said anything. But I reached the point where I couldn't take it anymore. And so I made an appointment with our counselor at work, our employee assistance counselor, who had me in a treatment center within a matter of a couple of weeks. I knew I needed help. I knew I couldn't do it on my own. And yet when he said, go to the treatment center, I said, well, I can't go this week, you know, because I'm busy doing the budget, and I can't go that week because it doesn't fit the schedule and this kind of thing. I did go. Miracle of miracles, I did go. But I went 2 or 3 weeks later. And I was there for 5 weeks. And I took my desire chip at the meeting in the treatment center, and I remember the sense of relief, the tears, and the sense of relief that I had managed to choke out those words, I'm an alcoholic, you know? And the support was just unbelievable. So that was my first meeting on the Tuesday. And I came to this room on the Tuesday night for Tuesday Beginners and sat through both meetings and just couldn't get enough, just could not. I was just sitting there, just taking it all in, terrified still, but having a sense that it was going to be okay. When I heard people say that they were 10 years sober, it was like, never me. That I didn't have the faith or the confidence that I could stay sober, because I didn't have a track record that said I could stay sober. But you know what? One day at a time, with a lot of support and a lot of friends and the program, I celebrated my 12th anniversary a couple of weeks ago. And it amazes me when I think back. I say, where did that time go? I also say the same thing when I look in the mirror and see the gray hair, and I say, where did the time go? But the years have been amazing. Initially, as relieved as I was to admit to being an alcoholic, because it meant I could be honest, I could talk to people who understood what I was saying, who understood the pain and everything that I had been through, at the same time, there was shame, and there was fear that somebody would see me going into a meeting. I felt like I had this brand on me, you know, alcoholic. There was a lot of shame and a lot of fear about people knowing. That's gone. That's gone. When Sandy told me this meeting was being taped, I said, that's okay. That's cool. It doesn't worry me anymore. But that lasted for a while. And I discovered that in saying I am an alcoholic, I was admitting being an alcoholic, but I was not yet there in accepting that I was an alcoholic. That took time for me to accept and know that this was who I was. I started out meetings. We were told in treatment we had to go to 2 meetings a week. I went to 3, I went to 4, I went to speaker meetings, I went to discussion meetings, and one of the things I did early on was to go to women's intensive weekends. And they were a wonderful, wonderful, safe place to learn about the steps, to share, to exchange, a very loving group of women. And I did that for a number of years. You know, sobriety has been, it's been a trip. This meeting doesn't have the steps up, but, you know, some meetings have, some Monday Central had the steps posted up, and I remember looking at them and saying, well, gee, those are interesting, but I don't really think I need to do those because I was such a paragon of virtue, you know, I didn't need to do a fourth step or a fifth. Terrified I was, that's what it came down to. But I did go through the steps. I also thought early in sobriety that if I read more, if I you know, studied more, if I went to more meetings, that I would just get better faster, and then I would be perfect, and that would be it, you know. And again, it came as a bit of a shock that it doesn't work that way. That I'm a work in progress, and it's a lifelong process that goes on. So I settled into, okay, this is who I am, this is what life is, and that's cool. I screwed up the courage in sobriety. Well, I stopped smoking, and I think, you know, the steps helped me with that tremendously, and I know it's an outside issue, but for me, that was harder than giving up alcohol. For about 3 months, it was hell. I did that. And the thing I guess most proud of was that I went back to school after 27 years of not being in a classroom. And I can tell you that was terrifying. When I filed my application, I remember delivering it to Concordia and handing it over to the receptionist and saying, here's my application for admission. And she said, yeah, put it in the box over there. And I'm going, no, you don't understand. This is my application for admission. She says, yeah, in the box over there. You know, just a number. I started out not really knowing what I wanted to do. And 5 years later, finished a certificate program. And I'm actually using that as a part-time job now. I'm continuing on with my studies, and I love it. I'm now in a bachelor's program. Last year, I retired. And again, that was a major transition in life that was frightening beyond anything I wanted to think of, because all of a sudden, I would have all this free time, and I'm going, so what am I going to do? You know, I'd seen too many people not manage retirement well, in my opinion, and I was terrified. But, you know, one day at a time, I take courses, I found other activities, life is good. That's not to say life is perfect. I have days that are, you know, like all of us, not every day is utopia, not every day is great. But I do know that if I stick to the principles of the program, that I will be okay. One of the gifts, there have been so many gifts in sobriety, and one of the biggest for me was finding a higher power of my understanding. I know when I came into the rooms, the word God didn't scare me. It does scare a lot of people. But I came from a family of what I call religious wars. You know, we had Catholics, we have Protestants, we have witnesses, we have you name it. But none of them that meant very much to me. So even though I believed, I was not practicing in any way. And one of the gifts, one of the big, the most important to me, I think, is discovering a higher power of my understanding. Knowing that no matter what, I'm looked after, no matter what, I'll be okay. So long as I do what I can do, what I need to do, that it'll be okay. And that's a wonderful feeling. It's taken me a long, long way. And today, as I said, I'm 12 years sober, and I'm looking forward to many more. I'm also looking forward to a long, ripe life, although the gray hairs are making me go, it's frightening when I look in the mirror. But life is good, and I know that none of it would be possible without my sobriety, without people in the rooms like this who are there to support me when I need it, and without a program that gives me a blueprint for how to live. And so with that, I thank you for listening, and I'm very glad I was here.